When Silas W. Haven volunteered to fight in the Civil War, he believed that the war was necessary to purify our nation of the sin of slavery and our other sins. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1862, Silas W. Haven of Rockford, Iowa, marched off to serve in the Civil War. He left behind his wife and three small children for four long years. During that time, he wrote nearly 200 letters home. Those letters have now been published in the new book, A Punishment on the Nation, An Iowa Soldier Endures the Civil War. I'll talk with editor Brian Miller, and we'll learn about the music of William C. Wright. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1862, Silas W. Haven of Rockford, Iowa, marched off to serve in the Civil War. He left at home his wife and three small children, and he was gone for 4 years. During that time, he wrote nearly 200 letters home, and all of those letters were saved. They've now been published in the new book, A Punishment on the Nation, An Iowa Soldier Endures the Civil War. And with me now is the editor of the collection. He's also assistant professor and associate chair of history at Emporia State University in eastern Kansas. And with me is Brian Miller. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on.
Let's talk a little bit about Silas Haven before the war. He was a native New Englander. What brought him to Iowa?
It looks like he made the journey to Iowa from Vermont, then to Pennsylvania, actually, for a little bit of time. Then he ended up in Illinois for a brief period of time, and then moved into Iowa right before the American Civil War. So he lived in several different parts of the country before the war. It looks like for the most part he was looking for new economic opportunities for the most part. After being educated in Pennsylvania, he and his family ended up moving out with his parents out to Illinois for a period of time. And then many of the citizens of that particular region, I believe it's Winnebago County in Illinois, ended up then moving to eastern Iowa once Iowa was available for settlement.
When he moved to the Midwest, you mentioned with his family, he was a young man.
Right, absolutely. In his 20s.
All right. And he got married in Illinois?
He did, yes. That's where he met his wife, Sarah Jane Knapp. He affectionately calls her Jane throughout most of the letters, the correspondence during the war. And then they had three children, Ella, who was the oldest daughter, Emmett, the middle son, and Laura, the youngest child, who he affectionately called Kitty through most of the letters.
So, of course, we don't have a lot of the history before the letters, because I'm sure that any exchanges before that time were probably not considered to be as precious as the ones that came home during the Civil War. But can you paint us a little bit of a picture of the family's life in Rockford, Iowa before that time in 1862?
It seems like, from what I've been able to gather, particularly I think reading through some of the correspondence in the war, there's quite a few references back to things that are going on at home. And from the time that I spent in Rockford and researching the community a little bit itself, we get a sense that these are, you know, Silas Haven is a carpenter, so it would have been a very small homestead that he would have lived on, doing odd carpenter jobs from time to time. The community had a mill that was becoming very active, which was bringing more settlers to the region. We know that it was a small farmstead that he lived on with a few acres of land that would have had some cattle, according to some of the correspondents mentioning that the cattle that was present on the farm as well. And he was very active in the church as well. So the church was a very important part, not just of the community itself, but of Haven's family. So it seems for the most part that it would have been a very sort of regular farm life that you would see from many Midwesterners who were living in mid-19th century America. And that religion was so important
on a daily basis. The family, he and Jane, were two of the founding members of the Baptist Church in Rockford,
right,
Iowa.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, it was so important for him to be a founding member of that church and then to continue being active with the church and constantly checking in with his wife and even writing correspondence to the church during the course of the war itself to make sure that the church was keeping up, if you will, its godly duties in order to to be a good beacon of hope and light during the course of the war itself.
So they were economically okay. They were not a wealthy family, but they weren't struggling more than anybody else living on the frontier at that time, at least not that we knew.
Correct.
And he volunteered to go fight in the Civil War. We know that a lot of Iowans volunteered to go fight in the Civil War. Do we know what prompted him to take that step? It seems like such an unthinkable move in some ways, leaving a wife alone with three small children in a new state almost.
What's fascinating about Haven also is he's 36 years old at the time that he makes this decision to enlist. And he enlists late in August of 1862, meaning the war has been going on for a full year. And it seemed, fortunately enough, this collection of correspondence included a letter, which where the title of the book comes from, that was written by Silas Haven to his parents in February of 1862, about 6 months before his enlistment, that I think gives us some clues as to why he is enlisting in the war itself. He really believes that the American Civil War is a punishment on the nation, that he believes that the country has not done enough to eradicate the sin of slavery, and that the war is God's punishment on the nation for allowing so much turmoil and bloodshed to be exhibited upon the African Americans through the institution of slavery itself. He is also a staunch unionist. He believes in the cause of the Union, particularly the cause of the Republican Party. The Republican Party was huge in Rockford. In fact, they staunchly voted for Abraham Lincoln in 1860. Haven is a very proud Republican. He's a proud patriot of his country as well. And I think as he sees the course of the war going on, and particularly his own abolitionist instincts, his religious instincts, and his patriotism drive him to make the decision as a 36-year-old man to go and enlist in the war and leave behind his wife and three children.
Now, clearly he believed, and he mentions in a couple of different ways throughout this correspondence, he believed that slavery was a great sin, but he also believed that the nation was being punished for other sins as well. At least
right.
he mentioned that in one of, at least one of his letters.
Right. I mean, there's the nation seems to be, particularly in the 1850s, moving into the 1860s, into this maybe a darker place religiously that Haven talks about, and that he is worried that particularly the American people and the church going public as well is not necessarily on the appropriate religious track that they should be. And this, that the war in some ways could help eradicate not just the sin of slavery, but maybe all sins that the American public was participating in at this time period. It's why I think at times he's very irritated, let's say, at some of his fellow soldiers in arms who are, you know, rowdier in camp or drinking or are not, or card playing, or maybe not going to religious services when they are available. It seems he feels that the entire nation is moving away from a desired sense of religiosity.
This set of letters is so complete, which it's incredibly impressive that they were preserved in all together and have been preserved for so long. One of the things that struck me, though, in reading this collection of letters is that so much of his experience during the war was really, truly unremarkable. He didn't see a great deal of combat. He spent a lot of time guarding railroads and just standing duty.
And that's what I thought was so great about the collection, because in many ways, his experience mirrors what many soldiers went through. There is a long, I think when Americans tend to think about the Civil War or through maybe viewing Ken Burns' series or reading a grand narrative of the war, it's usually battle by battle. And I think we have this conception that soldiers are fighting constantly, that there's a big battle and then there's another big battle. But there's a lot of downtime between those military campaigns. And soldiers, particularly some from the Midwest, weren't even involved in those big campaigns, as you mentioned. They were pivotal in orchestrating those battles from behind the lines, guarding railroads, making sure that supplies could move back and forth, that soldiers could move back and forth, that those rail lines stayed open, that communication lines stayed open during the course of the war. Haven travels up and down on riverboats, particularly up and down the Mississippi River, up and down the Red River during the course of the war, spending time in New Orleans on guard duty, just keeping those union lines intact. And it gave him an enormous amount of time to write as well, which as an editor, you can imagine I was extremely thrilled about, because these letters are so rich and detailed, because he had that extra time to really convey what he was thinking about, how he felt, not just about what he was going through on a daily basis, but all sorts of issues in the country. He takes time on several occasions to talk about what he's seeing and how he's feeling and what he's thinking about.
Can you give me a couple of examples?
In his travels throughout the South, he has quite a few. He had not spent time, according to what I've been able to discover and based on the insights in the letters, he had never been to the American South before. So he was really struck by Southerners. Particularly, he didn't care for the fact that Southern women were engaging in chewing tobacco. He found that to be a completely disgusting habit.
He wrote to his daughter about, his right. oldest daughter, in great detail about how disgusting it was.
I think he maybe had the Gone with the Wind image of Southern belles, you know, politely sashaying across the plantation. And here he sees, you know, common Southern women on the riverbank spitting tobacco juice. In fact, one of the amusing statements I found where he makes this comment that he sees a mother black bear and some cubs, and he finds her and the cubs more civilized than Southern women who are engaging in chewing tobacco on a regular basis. He was also very upset at Southern women who were not very enthusiastic about swearing oaths of allegiance to the United States government as the Union armies came through and were doing oaths of allegiance. Some Southern women were very angry and hostile to the Union officer takers during that period of time. He also gives a lot of insights into seeing African Americans for the first time, especially some who are inflicted with smallpox and other diseases that are breaking out in freedmen's camps that he encounters. So there's a lot of rich detail about different sorts of groups that you would encounter in the American South.
Well, I thought his comments on the slaves were particularly interesting because it clearly was a group of people he just had not encountered before. And although he certainly didn't believe in slavery, the way he talked about these slaves was not as if he was talking about his fellow soldiers. He was definitely grouping them as a group that sounded a bit condescending, the way he talked about them.
Yeah, and I think in some ways his language would mirror how individuals in the 19th century would have written about race in particularly. I don't think, even being a staunch abolitionist and against the institution of slavery, which I think some of those ideals probably come from his New England upbringing. I think his Vermont identity and many of his fellow community members who transplanted and moved across the country and eventually end up in Iowa, I think those religious and abolitionist ideals that he would have grown up in and been educated about are really transparent in his life. But as you mentioned, it's a very sort of, you know, average description when he sees African Americans for the first time. You know, he will just say, he will use language, particularly in one case, I believe he uses the term darkies, he uses the term Negro quite a bit, just to give a very general impression without any real specific details.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back into our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking to Brian Miller. He's the editor of the new collection. It's called A Punishment on the Nation, An Iowa Soldier Endures the Civil War, a collection of 200 letters sent home during the Civil War. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up a little later in the hour, we all know about architect Frank Lloyd Wright, but few of us know that his father actually lived in Iowa for a time, and he was a composer. We're going to find out about the music of William C. Wright and the life of William C. Wright coming up later in the hour. Right now, my guest is Brian Miller. He is the editor of a collection of letters called A Punishment on the Nation, An Iowa Soldier Endures the Civil War. It's a collection of nearly 200 letters that were sent home by Private Silas W. Haven of Rockford, Iowa, as he served in the Civil War for 4 years, beginning in 1862. Brian Miller is also assistant professor and associate chair of history at Emporia State University in eastern Kansas. And Brian, before the break, we were talking about how Haven wrote about the African Americans, the slaves that he encountered as he traveled through the southern part of the United States. And I was taken by one of the passages that he wrote about the freed slaves that were being inscripted into the Union forces. And he did compliment them. He said, watching them train, they seemed to learn faster than the white troops he had seen training. Although then he sort of took it away from them by saying, because they have nothing else to think about.
Right. And I think that it mirrors in many ways how many white Americans thought African Americans would fight during the American Civil War. I think there was this great hesitation to enlist black soldiers because they believed in some of the stereotypical images of that 19th century Americans had about black Americans, that they wouldn't fight well, that they wouldn't be willing to pick up the gun and engage in a battle appropriately. I think there's a little bit of this. Many listeners are probably familiar with the film Glory, which does a great job of telling the story of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. There's a particular scene where the black soldiers get guns for the first time and they're sort of playing with them and pretending to enact in a war. And I think that's how many white Americans thought that they would act once they got guns in their hands and started participating in battle. But I was thrilled to see that Haven did have these positive impressions watching black soldiers get ready to be trained and go into battle. It was comforting to see that maybe his thought process was a little bit ahead of how others would have perceived black soldiers at the time period.
Something else that I was struck by, he did seem to have disdain for the people of the South in many ways, and clearly he did not like secessionists. But he probably wrote with the most venom about a group of people called the Copperheads.
Correct.
And for people who don't know, who were the Copperheads?
The Copperheads are members of the Democratic Party who were against the American Civil War. They would have been your peace-loving individuals itself. The Copperheads were given this nickname of a venomous snake with a lot of disdain. And so anytime any Copperhead candidates, particularly in the correspondence between Haven and his mother is a staunch Republican just like he is, and in their brief correspondence, a lot of it is making sure that these Copperhead candidates, these anti-war candidates, don't get into office and end the war. There was a legitimate fear, particularly in 1864, that George McClellan, the Democratic nominee, would win the presidency and some argued would stop the war. He would sue for peace and that would be the end of the war, that those sacrifices that Union soldiers had made during the course of the war may be for nothing. And I think that's why Haven and his mother are very concerned about any Copperheads, any Democrats who would be against the war gaining any political office.
Do you think he was encountering people that he would have called Copperheads in service? Were there people in the military who'd been conscripted that would have this same belief?
Oh, absolutely. We know that amongst the soldier vote, I believe in the 1864 election, about 75 to 80%, I'm not sure on the specific statistic, but it's about over three-fourths of Union soldiers voted for Abraham Lincoln. But there's still a sizable portion who did not, who voted for the Copperhead candidate, as Haven would have called them. He doesn't necessarily note any particular soldiers that he's engaging with. He does keep an eye on the Iowa elections, the gubernatorial elections in Iowa, and is pretty thrilled that the Republican candidate prevails for the most part, that the Copperheads are not prevailing in these local races as well. But certainly he would have encountered some fellow Democrats in the ranks.
You mentioned that so much of the richness of these letters comes in the detail about his day-to-day life being in the military during this time. And he is so dutiful in laying down a lot of these details. And he's working so hard to keep his family going at home, and he obviously misses them very much, cares very much about them, very affectionate in his letters. But I think it's very interesting how he keeps track of all of the money that he's spent. And I can imagine that really offers us a real window into the economics of the time.
Absolutely, because he is sending money and gifts home on a regular basis. Some of the he usually, for the most part, made side notations in the letter. The letters, for the most part, are, if you think of a piece of let's say, notebook paper folded in half, so it would have been a four-sided letter that he was writing, he would usually make notations along the sides if there would be anything included in the letter itself to make sure that once this mail got to his wife and children, that they actually received the financial payment that was located inside. I think that's why he is very anxious when he doesn't get his pay. He makes constant reference to not getting paid yet. He's waiting for his money. It's not necessarily to buy things for himself, but it's so he can send that money back to his wife and children and allow her to orchestrate the business of the farm, to take care of things, to buy supplies that would be needed for the family to survive, and also just maintain the health and wellness of the children. We know that the young daughter Kitty gets an eye infection during the course of the war, and his mother has to purchase some salve, some ointment for her so her eye gets better. I mean, those are just necessary things that a family would have needed that soldier, that $13 a month in order to survive with. And I think that's why he lays all that out to say, I'm not spending a majority of the money on myself. I'm just using it for a few necessities.
Although we don't have the other side of this correspondence, he said that he was destroying his letters because he didn't want to leave them behind. He didn't want others reading his own personal business, and he couldn't really carry them with him, I would guess. But he's meticulous about responding to everything in his wife's letters. So we almost get a little bit of a window into the other side.
Absolutely. It seems that each letter is laid out in response, where he says, you know, his typical language is, you ask how I'm doing, or you ask how the march is, or you ask how the weather is. Well, let me tell you how that is. So we do get a sense of what she's probably asking him or wondering about in her correspondence. Fortunately, toward the end of the book in 1865, we do have a few letters that his wife wrote to him that are included in the collection, because somehow those letters may have been kept on him, or he may, I think, have sent them to other people, maybe his parents, and they would have kept those letters and they would have ended up in the collection as well. So even though we don't have her entire correspondence, I think, just as you mentioned, he gives us a lot of clues by saying, you asked this, so here is my response to this. And it's she seems to ask the same sorts of things, you know, how are you doing? You know, how are you feeling? How's the weather? How's the marching? How's camp life? And he likes to go into great detail in response each time.
Yes. You mentioned the gifts that he was sending home, and that kind of surprised me, because we think of these Union soldier camps as being places of deprivation, and many times they obviously were. Even his camp, although at one point he mentions that his wife had started a sewing circle, and you ask what we need, and we don't need anything, which kind of surprised me. But he was sending home little tokens for the children, buttons, a spoon, feathers.
Yeah, one of the advantages that he has is being, you know, not just those little tokens, but he's also having the advantage of being in some major communities. He's spending a lot of time in New Orleans, in Memphis, and especially around Jackson, Tennessee, and Memphis area. He spends quite a bit of the war in that particular region. So he's having access to urban communities where he may have been able to get other items. I think it's why he, for the most part, eats pretty well, not just the food that's served in camp, but he's able to go and get some other food items. And he has constant access to newspapers, guarding the rails. A lot of transportation items would come through. The sutler camps are being set up. He's very interested in acquiring a drum for his son. He knows that his son would just love being in camp and could just beat on the drum all day long. I'm not sure how the other soldiers would have felt about that, but Emmett certainly would have enjoyed that quite a bit.
He did see combat. I mentioned that he spent most of his time guarding the rails for 4 years, and most of the time fairly healthy as well. But he did see combat. What happened?
He participated in 1864, Nathaniel Banks, as part of Grant's, when Grant came to command all Union forces in the spring of 1864, there were different campaigns that were being stretched out across the country. And Nathaniel Banks' campaign was to go up the Red River through Louisiana into Texas. And Silas Haven actually participated a little bit on that expedition at the Battle of Fort DeRussy, where he's actually involved in some combat. He actually breaks down the battle pretty pretty detailed in terms of step by step, marching by marching. He actually gives the entire length of distance that he will actually march and engage in a brief period of combat. But that's really it for him in terms of battles. He would have been engaged at the Battle of Nashville, but he was sick. He actually ended up ill, having chronic dysentery from time to time through the course of the war. And then he suffered a hernia at Fort De Russy, which ended up being the basis for his pension application after the Civil War. To gain a little bit more financial assistance, he was able to utilize the hernia on his right side to get more money that he said that he had gotten when he charged into battle.
And he seems to be very suspicious of the Army doctors and Army medicine, which in retrospect seems very wise.
Surgeons had quite a bit to deal with. You can imagine that there is a clear medical crisis going on during the American Civil War. Surgeons who were overworked, underpaid, maybe underappreciated, lots and lots of patients. These childhood diseases that just ruptured across army camps. Soldiers who had never had measles or mumps or chicken pox and dysentery from the water and the food and the climate. It really just wreaked havoc, the Civil War did on the body. And Silas Haven is no different. He experiences chronic health problems through the course of the war, but I think very typical as to what other soldiers are going through. He's suspicious when he goes to the hospital tent. I think sometimes he just wants to stay and be by himself and rest and write, because he's not sure about the medical treatment that he's being given by the doctors and the surgeons. And I think that's very typical. I think you have a group of men who are going off to war for the first time, who maybe had just experienced a frontier doctor, if they even had a family physician. And now all of a sudden they're being put into hospitals with men who they don't know, who are walking by very quickly, and it makes them very nervous.
Well, and his wife is very sweet in encouraging him. No, it's okay to take the medicine that they give you, although I was thinking, no, that's probably good, with all the mercury poisoning that we know about as a result of a lot of Civil War medicine. But how is it that this remarkable collection remained intact for so many years, and how did you come to find it?
I had the great fortune of speaking about the American Civil War in one of my history classes at Emporia State University, and one of my students, Kathy Walker, was really fascinated by the Civil War, and she, I guess, brought this up at a family dinner, and her grandmother reminded the family that they had this box of about 200 letters. They were in perfect, pristine condition. It's like they literally had been written yesterday. The paper was perfectly preserved. They were all still in the original envelopes with the original postage still on them. We know a lot of Civil War postage disappeared, particularly when people had rough economic times. But all of the letters still had the postage intact, and she asked me if I'd like to see a couple of these letters. And I said, well, absolutely, I'd love to read. So she brought five of them to my office one day, and the first letter I read was the first letter in the book, where he calls the war the punishment on the nation. And I just put down the letter. I said, I have to see this whole collection. And after, you know, meeting with the family, and they agreed for me to publish the collection of letters, I was very fortunate that this volume fell into my lap by the good graces of a student who was really sparked by a class lecture on the Civil War.
That is so remarkable. And this collection, there have been other collections of letters published. There have been Civil War diaries published. And of course, there have been so many books written about the Civil War. What does this collection of letters give us that we haven't gotten before?
We don't have a lot of correspondence from soldiers from the Midwest, believe it or not, and very little from the state of Iowa. There's only maybe a dozen books, particularly of collections of correspondence from soldiers from Iowa. And Iowa sent over 70,000 soldiers to fight in the American Civil War. So it's great to actually get that perspective from not just a Midwesterner, but maybe a Midwesterner who has that New England background, who is not seeing as much combat in the American Civil War. I think that's one of the great gems of this collection, is we're not getting a lot of battle detail that maybe a lot of general readers would know about the American Civil War. They know what happened at the big battles, but they may not be as aware about what the daily grind of being a soldier is. And also, because Haven had so much time to write, he really allows you to go inside his mind, to go through his thought process, to see how he thinks about every sort of issue that is important in 19th century America, whether it's gender-related, race, class, just religion, slavery, politics. It's all laid out in exquisite detail that really allows you to work through his mind in many ways, to watch him think out something, think about how he feels about the American Civil War, and then watch that evolution as he goes and see how, in many ways, his principles are still steadfast, even after going through the tough grind of marching and constant traveling and the bad food from time to time and the chronic pain. He still has that intellectual justification for the war so firm in his mind that I think keeps him going on a daily basis. He knows he's fighting for something bigger and grander, and it sustains him in many ways. That and the chance to get home and see his wife and three kids.
And I think that eternal optimism.
Right. He always believes that the war ending is right around the corner, that it's winding down and he will be home any day now.
We only have a moment left, and I'm sure many people are wondering what happened to him when he came home.
When he got back to Rockford, the town really expanded. It grew very, very quickly, and he ended up working in a furniture business with his carpenter background. It actually made him pretty wealthy. He ended up owning real estate worth about $1,800 after the war, but he was still plagued with constant pain, particularly from the hernia that he had gotten from that charge in battle, so he ended up filing for his military pension. And he remained very active in the community, working with the First Baptist Church. He ended up at a couple different roles. He served as the township clerk. He got elected Justice of the Peace, and then eventually passed away in the 1890s.
And left a strong family and a legacy of these letters.
Absolutely. Yeah, that the generations that are still surviving today.
Brian, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Charity.
Brian Craig Miller is the editor of the collection A Punishment on the Nation, An Iowa Soldier Endures the Civil War. It's a collection of nearly 200 letters written by Private Silas W. Haven of Rockford, Iowa, who volunteered to serve in 1862. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all know a little bit about Frank Lloyd Wright, and many of us are proud of the influence he had on architecture in Iowa. There's another gifted Wright who lived in Iowa, who very few of us have even heard of. His name was William C. Wright, and among other things, he was a composer. David Patterson is a music historian. He'll be giving a lecture about William C. Wright and his music in Iowa City at noon tomorrow as part of the State Historical Society of Iowa's History for Lunch lecture series, and he's with me now. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, not many of us have heard of William C. Wright. How did he come to your attention?
Well, I am very interested in Frank Lloyd Wright, and William C. Wright is his father. We don't know much about him, though, because Frank Lloyd Wright went to great pains to excise most of his mentions of his father. And what he did say, I think scholars for many years have agreed, is unfair and quite slanted. So I am interested in him both as a music historian, but also as someone who's interested in Frank Lloyd Wright biography.
All right. Well, we will talk about the parts of life that they shared, some of them stormy, a little later on. But let's go back to the start for William C. Wright. Where was he born? Where did he grow up?
William C. Wright was born in 1825 on the East Coast in Connecticut. He had a really very itinerant life. He married his first wife, Pamelia Holcomb, in 1850, and that was in Utica, New York. And very few people know that Frank Lloyd Wright's mother was actually William's second wife. And it's this first wife, Pamelia, with whom he had three children, and it's that side of the family that's been really solely responsible for maintaining the legacy of William C. Wright.
And as he was growing up, he was always musically inclined, but his mother didn't particularly approve of that.
No, there was a wonderful quote from a letter that she wrote in 1844. He would have been 19 years old, and she said, "As for William, he's all music, music. I think he'll make something if he tries, but I feel troubled on his account at times as well as the rest of the children. I felt very desirous that my son should occupy useful stations in the Church of God. He came from a long line of ministers, and in fact, he later became a preacher himself, first Baptist and then Unitarian.
And his first wife, you mentioned they married in 1850.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a bit of music that he wrote at that time in his life. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of that, and you can tell us a little bit about what was going on. This was written at the age of 25, and this is the
Hemlock Ridge Quick Step. He wrote this while he was a teacher at a girls' finishing school in New York, and that's where he met Permit.
Let's listen.
Sure.
That's the Hemlock Ridge Quick Step, and as you mentioned, he wrote that at the age of 25. When you listen to the music, what does that tell you about him as a musician?
Well, this tells me that we're dealing with a young composer, and more importantly, a young composer in America, which means a real struggle, probably trained through, we know his brother who was a musician, maybe trained through singing schools, which were common at the time. No real conservatory training necessarily. He'd had some classes in music at the colleges he attended, but certainly there was no such thing as a music degree back then. The only person that we think of, I think, today in American music history from that period is Stephen Foster. But there were so many people who were, besides him, who were also composing music. And I think William Wright is a wonderful example of an American composer who's trying to make it in the early 19th century.
What were his ambitions? Do we know?
Well, in terms of ambition, he wrote books about music, I mean, textbooks. There are two books about piano method, one about vocal method. The pieces that he wrote for piano are mainly for his student, intermediate level. There are a handful of pieces that are more complex, and he probably wrote those for himself to perform in concert. And there are also a series of cabinet organ pieces, as well as songs that are really parlor songs. You know, they're meant to be sung after dinner, brother playing the piano, sister singing sort of scenario. So it's all very functional and in that way very commercial. But clearly, throughout his entire life, he wanted to be a professional musician and make his living at that.
And he really struggled to do that. He and Pamelia, as you mentioned, they had three children and a few stillborn children in there as well. So there were many children.
Yes.
But what brought them to the Midwest? They came first, was it to Wisconsin?
He and Pamelia, yes, came to Wisconsin. We're not quite sure why. She may have had relatives in the Wisconsin area. But it wasn't too long after they got here before in 1864.
And as he looked for work, he seemed to keep falling into preaching.
Yes, probably the family business. Now, before, I mean, he had started off as an attorney. And he worked for several years as an attorney, and then around 1863 or so, became ordained as a Baptist minister. And later in life, he ministered on the side, as it were, but returned to law. And then at the end of his life, he went back to music again. So the ministry and the law were really tangents to what was he had hoped for, a life in music.
Well, and there are newspaper clippings that announce his arrival in a new town or in a new church, and it always mentions his music. It seems like he tried very hard to make it clear, well, yes, I'm preaching, but this is what I do.
Exactly, and that's certainly what happened when he moved his family to Iowa. And by then, Permelia had died. He had married Anna Lloyd Jones, who would be Frank Lloyd Wright's mother. And when they got to McGregor, Iowa, it was March or April of 1869, The newspaper announced it, and as you said, that's exactly right. Mr. Wright is not professionally a clergyman, though he preaches very acceptably when requested to do so. His business is with music, the tuning of pianos, organs, melodeons, and he also purchased an interest in a music department of a department store there.
Well, and I also want to mention that previous to this, he had been drafted to fight in the Civil War, but he bought his way out of service in a really unusual way.
He sold a violin, perhaps one of those that he himself had made. He was also a violin maker, and with that money was able to pay for a substitute.
$28.
That's it.
To send another man to fight in your place.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about Anna Lloyd Jones. As you mentioned, his second wife, the mother of Frank Lloyd Wright. This seemed to be a marriage that was troubled from the start, though.
I think so. They were married from 1866 to 1885. He married her with his three children from his previous wife, none of whom she particularly got along with. And in fact, one of them just simply had to leave to be away from her to escape the verbal and even physical abuse from Anna. Frank was always her very favorite, and she and William had a very contentious life, I think, in part because of the income that he wasn't able to bring in. And finally, in 1885, he filed for divorce on the grounds of desertion and was granted that divorce.
Well, there's a piece of music that we have a selection from called The Sunny Side of Life, and this was written in 1874, and it really seems as at odds with what would have been going on in his life at this time. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, The Sunny Side of Life is one of his songs, and it's one of two that I know of that's, I think, particularly fun because it has a quartet singing the chorus. And on the recording that I've made, because William played the violin, I wrote up a little violin solo arrangement in between the verses. But this was written when he had moved the family to Weymouth, Massachusetts, and he was preaching there. Lots of his music, I think, shows the underlying resilience and just buoyant spirit that he had in the face of all of the adversity he was facing, whether it was career or home.
All right, let's listen. That's just an excerpt, and actually, it's called The Sunny Side of Life, but it does sound a little melancholy, doesn't it? let's talk about his relationship with his son, Frank Lloyd Wright, because mm-hmm. as you mentioned, of course, being the far more famous of the two, Frank Lloyd Wright was able to write this history, and he did not write flattering things about his father. What has he said about him?
Well, he's told stories of a fist fight that he had with his father when he was a teenager, and basically cast his father as someone who was unsuccessful and abandoned his family, which is certainly not the case. And no one, I think, who, even Frank Lloyd Wright's most ardent admirers know that there are parts of his autobiography that are just outright pants on fire, if you will. So part of the challenge has been to suss out what's really true. I think Frank Lloyd Wright is very good about denying the impact that his influences have had on him and the degree that he goes to put William in a bad light, I think is a sign of how important William was. He was the intellectual model of the household. He taught him about music. He taught him about nature. I can't think of anyone more important in Frank Lloyd Wright's life for his first 18 years than his father.
And stormy marriage with Anna Lloyd Jones, or Anna Lloyd Wright,
mm-hmm.
They did finally get a divorce. And he sought counsel with his older children from his previous marriage about the divorce.
Yes. He went to visit them in Wahoo, Nebraska. These are the children from Pamelia Holcomb. And one of his sons said, you should come work with me and be in law practice. We have it in Elizabeth Wright Heller's autobiography. You know, John's, her brother, said it was bad enough to run the risk of hell in the next world without living it in this one. And they encouraged him to leave Anna. And he did indeed, with very little with him but his violins and some of the other things that he had in a bookcase. And he went to really resume life living with the three children from his first wife.
And he did practice law?
He practiced law briefly. He practiced law in Wahoo, we think, for about 5 years or so, but it wasn't, you know, too much longer before he went to Stromsburg, Nebraska, and was the director of the Central Conservatory of Music. And then he went to Kansas, Atchison, and St. Joseph, Missouri, where he started writing articles about music. And then in 1896, he came back to Iowa. And he lived for a year in Des Moines, and then 3 years in Perry, continued writing and also continued teaching at a music school. Then he was going to finally live with his daughter Elizabeth in Ladora, Iowa, and just settle there. So he was there for the last 2 years of his life, from 1902 to 1904.
Why do you think it's important to hear this music again and to talk about William Wright?
It's important to hear the music because the music, I think, speaks to the character and soul of who that person is more than anything that could be written in words. You get a much better picture of William through the music than through anything else. I think it's important to talk about him because if you take the Frank Lloyd Wright story and revise it at the beginning, that should have a ripple effect, I hope, through the rest of the way in which we interpret the story.
And what kind of light has it shed on their relationship, on this story for you? What has it meant to you?
It's really enhanced my understanding of the impact of music on Frank Lloyd Wright's art. He always said music was one of his most important influences. And in tracing what he said about music and architecture back to the source, I always came back to the lessons he would have learned through William.
And in listening to the music itself, you mentioned that it was really of a certain time, that maybe we don't have a lot of American composers. What can we learn just from the music itself?
From the music itself, this is a beautiful snapshot of 19th century American parlor music. When there were individuals who were trying to write music before a whole lot of the infrastructure was there to support them. Certainly no conductor would conduct a composition by an American composer. There couldn't possibly be such a thing. So these are the real pioneers of American music during that period.
And I can imagine that there are many composers with similar canons that that we just don't know about.
That who are completely nameless, absolutely.
So he represents many of them.
Absolutely.
They didn't have famous children.
No, not at all. And if it's true, if it weren't for Frank, we probably wouldn't be talking about William. But that's sort of beside the point. William is a wonderful way to gain access into Frank Lloyd Wright, and he's a wonderful figure in himself. I just add that the other Iowa connection is the State Historical Society of Iowa. It's not a coincidence that I'll be speaking there tomorrow. I'm doing that because the Elizabeth Wright Heller Collection is located there. It's the motherlode of scores for William Wright. Couldn't possibly find them anywhere else in many cases. And it's there because her granddaughter, Hope Rogers, who lives in Vinton, Iowa now, and now her great-granddaughter, Mary Rogers, have been the overseers of his legacy and deposited Elizabeth's collection of music and photographs and her own autobiography at the State Historical Society of Iowa. If they hadn't done that, we would know next to nothing about William.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
David Patterson is a music historian. He'll be giving a lecture about William C. Wright and his music in Iowa City at noon tomorrow as part of the State Historical Society of Iowa's History for Lunch lecture series. And we go out today with Robin's Morning Song, also by William Seawright. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about the science of seeds. This is Talk of Iowa.